Hello and welcome to the Beautifully Rare podcast. I'm Bryn Bish, and with me I have my co-host Sam Bish. In the past two episodes, we have talked about Sam's background and my background. In today's episode, we are talking all about Killian and the story of how one little warrior born with half of a heart fought and climbed his way through four open heart surgeries, a major cardiac arrest, severe brain injury diagnosis, all before the age of 6 months old. But before we get started, I want to go ahead and talk to you about our sponsor of today's episode, AIG Insurance. Now, guys, we have been with just about every type of insurance broker you can imagine, and nothing comes close to the quality and customer service that they have to offer with every single one of their clients. AIG understands that as busy parents with children who have medical needs, your time is precious, and that is why they are here to take the stress and confusion out of insurance. Their expert team of agents specialize in providing comprehensive coverage tailored to your family's unique needs, so you can focus on what matters most, which is, above all else, your kids. Whether it's home, auto, life, or commercial insurance, they offer personalized advice to support every step of the way. Let them handle the details while you take care of your family. Email info@aigmd.com. That's info@aigmd.com to get your free quote. So, Sam, let's start on the D-Day, diagnosis day.
Yeah, the big day.
The big day where all of this journey began. So I specifically remember that it was pouring down rain and like just warm enough to not really be snowing or icing or anything like that. It was just kind of like,
it was a like a sleet.
Yeah.
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 It was
like
a
miserable
complete opposite
day.
Side of the city too.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it was on that other side of the city, because it was a separate building, like a specialized clinic, right?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. It was. Because I had SMA, I was automatically placed in a maternal fetal medicine clinic.
Yeah, because I remember that first building, it was a lot closer.
Yeah.
And then they told us to go, oh, you have to go to this other building, you know, other side of the city, specialized clinic, all this kind of stuff. So we're making this trek in the sleeted weather, you know,
it's
in
terrible.
Mid-October of Cleveland. So anyway, we get there. I remember they bring us back, you know, we're having the ultrasound done. She was specifically commenting and talking about each body part and saying like, oh, the femur, you know, the length looks good. Mm-hmm. You know, the head circumference from what I can tell looks good, doing all the measurements. And then when she came to the heart, like, I feel like you talk about it the best. So like what was going through your head as a mom?
Well, I mean, you know, moms always have this like mom tuition
right.
a little bit. And so she gave all these like affirmations about things looking good, kidneys are where we need them to be, and then she gets to the heart and complete silence.
Yeah.
For like 5 minutes, and she's like, she's on the heart. And so I remember thinking like, she's not saying the heart looks good, and so she was saying everything else looked good. That doesn't, you know, like a little yellow flag went off.
Yeah.
But then
the concern. Is
yeah. The concern. But then she was like, oh, we're going to, you know, she's like, okay, we're all finished. And she, oh, that's when she went to the gender and she was like, okay, are you guys ready to figure out what you're having? And she was super excited. And and so I was like, okay, maybe I'm just making it up in my head. Right. And so we found out we were having a boy. We were like super excited. And then, actually, no. I wanted a girl.
You wanted a girl. I wanted a boy.
I wanted, yeah.
Which I feel like is stereotypical.
It is. Yeah. But now being a boy mom, I'm like, hands down, I would love to have all boys. They're just the best. They're just so sweet. They're just the sweetest things. So anyways, my fears were kind of, you know, squashed a little bit because she was so bubbly and excited. And I was like, well, if it was serious enough, I feel like she would rush out of the room and get someone, right? And then it was like immediately, you know, squelched when she said, okay, I'm just going to get the doctor. And then, you know, you guys are free to go. She specifically said free to go. So I was like, okay, well, if it was really serious, like she wouldn't say that phrase.
Yeah.
And I thought it was like standard protocol about like, you know, the doctor just signs off and, you know, gives the congrats and then you're on your
way. Well, I mean, like I said, I'm pretty sure that is. Like, I think that's how it works.
I don't know. Well,
I mean, I guess we'll find out, but
yeah.
I mean, I feel like a doctor has to sign off on things anyway. That's right. Coming from a very non-professional medical opinion.
But, yeah. so if any sonographers are listening,
yeah,
feel free to comment. So anyways, and then what happened after that?
So she leaves the room. She says, I'm going to go get the doctor. We knew it was a boy, and we had some names we were kind of kicking around trying to decide on. But I remember I looked at you, mm-hmm. and like in my head right then and there, I was like, we should name him Killian.
Yeah.
Like, that's his name. It was just like,
what about the name was like, made you say yes?
I mean, obviously the meaning of it, little warrior, in Gaelic. I don't know, just firstborn, you know, firstborn son. It's a strong name, especially the meaning. And I mean, your name Bryn is strong, in Gaelic. So it's, you know, the Gaelic connection.
Yeah.
I feel like that was, you know, something that kind of stood out to me.
But and then also the fact that you're a Marine, like it kind of tied.
Yeah.
You know, like
that's
strong
fair.
Number one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So just like, you know, warrior spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I remember I looked at you. I said, Killian, that's his name. And you didn't even question it.
Yeah. I was like, okay, that's the name.
Yeah.
And we had a pretty good, if I didn't have the job I have now, my other job would be thinking of baby names professionally, because I have.
Is that even a job?
I don't know. It should be. Actually, I think it is a job.
Is
I think
it?
Okay. Somewhere out there. Anything's a job
if you
market it the right way.
That's fair.
So we named him Killian, and I think that total span time between her leaving and us naming him Killian and the doctor coming in was what, like 30 seconds? It had to be like less than
if a that minute. Yeah, it was very quick.
Yeah.
And you know, you think, oh, I'm gonna go get the doctor. Usually you sit there and you wait for like 5 minutes.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
which is fine. But
and here we are thinking like, okay, we're just like, we need the final approval and then we're yeah. out. We can get lunch or breakfast.
Grab lunch.
And then I had classes later that afternoon.
Yeah,
and
I got to go back to work. So yeah, he walks back in, says, I'm pretty convinced, right? I think that was like he didn't officially give us the diagnosis, but
yeah,
he was like, from what I'm seeing, your son is missing his left ventricle. He has something that's called hypoplastic left heart syndrome, which means he's missing his left ventricle. I want you guys to clear your schedules for the rest of the day. I remember he was very, very point blank about that. And that's when I just remember feeling kind of numb, almost just like a, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, like,
I don't think it hit me at that point, but it's interesting that it hit you at that point.
I mean, I'm very in the moment. Like that's how, you know, but I remember he said, clear your schedules for the rest of the day. I'm going to set you up with appointments with specialists, mm-hmm. not specialists, specialists. And you are going to, you know, they're going to confirm the diagnosis. You're going to talk about a little bit about what that looks like, mm-hmm. you know, get your options from there. And so we walked out of the office and there was like a couple hour break, right? Mm-hmm. Like he said, you know, I'm going to set you up with a couple appointments, clear your schedule. It'll be in the afternoon. Yeah. We're like mid morning at this point. Yeah. I can't remember the exact time, but it was closer to breakfast than lunch. I'm pretty sure. Anyway, we found the nearest Dunkin' Donuts, which was like a couple blocks down the road. Yep. We pull into the parking lot. We walk in there. Like I said, I'm still kind of numb at this point, just trying to understand what just happened, having no idea of the ramifications of like what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember I looked at you and I said, do you want a donut? Do you want anything to eat? I can't remember if you wanted anything or not. But so I went up to order the food. I'm standing there waiting. I look back at you. You're holding the phone like you're on speakerphone and you're crying. And I just remember in that moment, like, this is not good.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, the certain memories that get burned into your brain about, like, the looks on people's faces. Yeah, I think we had a little bit of a disconnection between, because it's like, you know, Sam and I were ready to love whatever child, whatever form of it.
Absolutely.
You know, that was going to, you know, defect or not, you know, abnormality or not, we were ready to love it as, you know, as God ordained us to do for that particular life that he gave us. And so we had this like untethered, like, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
You know, like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
What, I don't know what HLHS is. I don't know what hypoplastic left heart syndrome is, but you know, whatever it is, we'll figure it out.
I certainly wasn't thinking at that moment, year long hospital stay, surgeries. I was thinking, I don't know,
a mild defect or something.
Yeah. Something,
you know?
But yeah, looking back at you while I'm standing up there waiting for our coffee.
Yeah.
Crying. Like,
and I remember because he said the three appointments he had for us to set up later that afternoon was a geneticist, cardiologist, and then like one other specialist. And so I remember at the Dunkin' Donuts, I texted my brother who is in the medical field. He's an ERPA.
Yeah.
And we had been texting early on in the morning, and I just said, you know, like, guys, we just got a diagnosis for Killian. By the way, it's a boy. By the way, his name is Killian.
Yeah.
But we also have this thing. Like, I texted my family immediate, and I just said, like, pray for us. We don't really know what this is, but it sounds pretty serious. And so, you know, my brother and I were kind of texting back and forth, and he was responding really quickly. I know he had off that day. And then he said, well, can you text me the diagnosis? Like, can you spell it out? And I texted him back and I said, do you know anything about this, after I texted? And I didn't hear anything from him until I got back from Duncan, until we got to Duncan. And I knew that, like, his silence meant that, number one, he was researching, and number two, it was not something he wanted to talk about over text, which meant it was pretty serious. So that was like my mom flag number two. Even though I was completely disassociated with what this diagnosis was, that was like my second flag of like, ooh, maybe this is like a little bit more serious than we thought.
Yeah.
So how I, you know, when you were getting coffee, I guess the back road to that is that we had agreed to, like, just, you know, once we get coffee and, you know, food and whatever, to sit down and just research what this is before we have all of these appointments in the afternoon. We just needed to know. Mm-hmm. So we type in HLHS, hypoplastic left heart syndrome, and immediately the first three things that popped up were infant death, open heart surgery, high mortality. And then... Yeah. All, and then everything after that was just like my clouds, my eyes just flooded with like just wetness. And that was the moment that I remember feeling just very, very hopeless of like, you know, what is this? Like, what is this like acronym diagnosis that is causing what I'm seeing in Google like to come true? So my brother calls me, and because he didn't text me, and so I called him, and he goes, how much do you know? He didn't even say, hey, how are you? He just, like, his first statement was, how much do you know? And I said, I know enough. And he goes, okay. So, and then he asked me, he said, do you know about the surgeries? Now, I hadn't gotten that far down in the search to really talk about the surgeries. And then this is where you kind of came back with the coffee and everything. And so
this is when you dropped the sobering news on me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, of course, like in that moment, a million thoughts, right? And so, you know, Zach is my brother's name, but he said, you know, do you know about the surgeries? I'm researching that they're very new, but they're getting better every year. And he goes, it looks like Boston Children's is like the place to be.
Yeah.
That was the first time Boston had been mentioned.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in my book quite a bit about this was like, you know, this was like an hour time span and so much happened.
Yeah.
Like God's timing is so perfect in this way. He doesn't miss a second. He doesn't miss a minute. Everything is ordained how it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And he can absolutely use the bad things of this world to display his beauty and his power. And this is just one of the situations. And if you guys are curious about how that is laid out, see my book. It kind of details all of this. But one of the things that, you know, that I thought was so powerful is we named Killian Little Warrior, and we knew that that was the meaning of it, and we named him that 30 seconds before we got this heavy diagnosis that we were just unpacking the severity of it. And so we're researching about these surgeries, these babies, these infants. Low mortality rate, low successful rate, low, like, high heart transplant requirements, low ability to get a heart transplant. Like, everything was terrible. But then there was, like, at the bottom of the page, we saw an article that talked about how these little guys who make it through are called what? They're called?
Heart warriors.
Heart warriors.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so we named our son Little Warrior like 45 minutes before we find out that, you know, these guys are called Heart Warriors and that there's a ray of hope and ability for these kids to actually make it through these surgeries, even though it's very, very slim and low.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, at diagnosis day, was also the kind of, it was the day that we tried to kind of begin planting some semblance of a plan, right? It's like, okay, we find out that these surgeries are possible, but what we were finding was that dependent on the center you actually go to, your success rate can go, you know, from 45% up to 70%, depending on the surgeon that's there, the team that's able to provide.
How frequently they perform the surgeries obviously increases the success rate.
Yeah.
But in a way, and sorry to cut you off, but seeing the institution Boston Children's Hospital and specifically the city Boston, us knowing that we were already planning to move there before any of this happened, in a way felt, at least to me looking back on it, kind of comforting, like reassuring, like, okay, you know, God already had us kind of moving in that direction anyway. We get this diagnosis. Oh, one of the best places, if not the best place to be in the country for this, is Boston.
Yes.
So,
this wasn't even like a God wink. This was a God, you know, taking you by the hand and like dragging you. It wasn't even like a little nudge. Or anything. There wasn't anything soft about this plan. It was like,
it
God.
It was like, yep, I've already got this plan. Come on, we're going. Yep, let's go right now.
Yeah, literally. It's like God waking you up in the middle of the night and saying, like, pack your bags. We're going out.
Yep.
Yeah, so we get home from Dunkin' Donuts. Of course, like and nobody talks about this on diagnosis day, but it's the haze. It's like just the mental, like, fog that kind of like overwhelms your mind. Like, you can't think. All you want to do is cry, but then you have a million questions. You have 10 gajillion things to plan. Oh, and by the way, you're working and you have to maintain law school stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And so we were, you know, my brother provided really helpful advice, which was, you need right now, the most important thing for you to figure out, you have 18 more weeks. You have to figure out where you have to go.
Yeah.
Like, if it's staying here in Cleveland, make a plan. If it's going to Boston, make a plan. If it's going to Texas, make a plan. So then we started praying immediately, like, Lord, you need to show us where you want us to go for him.
Yeah. Well, and it was so we started praying, and you had a contact in the medical field that had a connection to somebody in cardiology, correct?
Yeah, so I call him and I'm like, what do I do? I don't know where to go. Like, I'm completely paralyzed. So he connects me to a doctor that he knows, and I talk to him on the phone, and he goes, yeah, you know, I know this is a long shot. You live in Cleveland, but if you can get to Boston Children's, like, they're the best of the best. Yeah.
Second time.
So this is like number two out of, like, okay, I don't know, 2-3 hours into our diagnosis. So then there was another connect. Oh, at the same time, I had just made a post. I wanted to, it was like my first Instagram post about this experience. I was like, you know, we're heavy-hearted, we're unpacking what this means, but it's a pretty serious diagnosis, blah, 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 blah. Someone random reaches out to me and says, like, hey, I just wanted to let you know, like, I have a little warrior that went through this. He's now 3. We went to Boston Children's. If you can get there, they are phenomenal. They're top-notch. Yeah. You need to go there. I'm like, okay. So the Lord's clearly telling me,
this is we where need you to need
go
to be.
Boston.
Yep.
And so so I had reached back out to during the conversation with the Johns Hopkins physician connection that Dr. Crawford had, he said, I actually know someone at Boston Children. Let me just reach out to them to see if they can get you an appointment to go and, you know, get a scan. So I'm like, you know, I can't imagine that they have any time to see us this week. I mean, like, I have 18 weeks to plan a move to Boston. Like, we need to get him scanned and figured out, like, this week.
Not only that, but you know how new patient appointments go. You usually have to wait a couple months.
Oh, yeah, especially for a specialist. Like, there's just no way. I was like, okay, like, make the connection, whatever. No. 4 o'clock that evening, I had called the coordinator immediately after that phone call. So 4 o'clock that evening, she emails me back and says, hey, can you come in this coming Monday?
So we book the plane ticket. We figure out where we're staying. We're staying at Brendan's place. Mm-hmm. We're waiting in the airport. You know, we showed up, what, 4 or 5 a.m. We're sitting in the airport. We get on the plane. You know me. And most people that know me know I'm a very introverted person, right? So we're on this plane. You had the window seat. I was in the middle. And then we had... there was a lady sitting on the other side of me. Mm-hmm. And so being an introvert, you know, I throw my headphones in and I just listen to podcasts, or I was probably listening to a podcast, but, you know, I just zone out the entire trip. Mm-hmm. Well, by the time the plane's landing, you know, I'm taking my headphones out. I'm, you know, making sure I'm packed up. This lady looks over at me and I can't even remember what she said, but we started talking about something and you then turned over and you were like, Sam's talking to a stranger? That's odd.
Never would have thought.
Yeah.
I mean, we were both like stuck in our own grief and trying to process what just happened.
Yeah. So we strike up a conversation with this woman and she asks us, you know, what are you guys coming out here for? Is this for a, you know, vacation? You know, what's got you guys on the plane? And I remember we looked at each other and we were just kind of like, let's just be honest. You know, like, what, there's no point in just trying to, you know. So at that point, you were like, well, you know, go into the story. Our son just got this diagnosis. He's, you know, we're 20 weeks out. Or anyway, we're going out here for basically a second opinion to see, you know, what this looks like and if we can get enrolled in this program. And so I remember she said, you know, I never do this. But something is just laying it on my heart that I need to just give you my phone number. Here's my name. Here's my phone number. Please call me. Like, I live out here. I'm from here. If you need anything at all, like, contact me. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that that happens incredibly often, but that's not like an abnormally strange thing for a stranger to do. You know, like, oh, that's very kind of you. Like,
we even said that to, we were like, she was so nice.
Yeah.
But like, you know, we're obviously not going to reach out to a stranger.
Yeah. Like,
but, you know,
we're not going to. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, talk with her, finish up the conversation. She goes on her way. Fast forward to us actually getting to Brendan's place. She finds you on Facebook.
Yeah.
Right?
Like that night she friend requests me and she was like, hey, I'm Dale from the plane.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, she's so nice.
Yeah. So she ends up becoming our Boston mom, mm-hmm. essentially. Such a huge blessing.
Yeah.
Just helping us with just random things that you think, you know, you have family to kind of help support in the area. Well, we're moving to Boston. Mm-hmm. The only other person that we knew that was there was Bryn's cousin, Brendan, who busy guy. He travels a lot for work. So, but he's not always there. So we didn't really have like a lot of that family support. If anything, we had no family support. We've met this random woman who ended up becoming our family support while we were living there.
I mean, just like the woman with the biggest heart. I mean, I've just never met someone who has as compassionate as this woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, again, what are the odds?
Filled our cupboards and our fridge when we first moved there.
Right.
I mean, that was a couple months later, but
like what are the odds of sitting down next to her in a, you know, a plane that didn't have assigned seating?
Yeah. Think of how many thousands of people fly in and out of Boston every single day.
Yeah. It was just, it was an amazing opportunity. So we get to Boston. We go in for we had a 7 a.m. appointment. And I remember Sam and I were so nervous that we got. We got there at like 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Because we were so anxious.
We showed up before the Starbucks even opened, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty crazy. And so we get our, you know, fetal echo and we meet with the team. And before this, we'd actually also talked and did a video call with places like Cleveland Clinic and other hospitals. And so by now we kind of knew what conversation we needed to have, like what were the talking points, what were the questions we needed to ask. And this was our cardiologists were like, they're at this point, they're like family.
Yeah.
But this was from the minute I met him, and her, Dr. Powell and Dr. Juro, from the minute we met them, they were just the people that we needed through this journey. He was incredibly honest. You know, he said, this is going to be a tough journey.
Yeah. But that's even something that we said when we were building that relationship at first is, you know, we're the type of people we'd much rather you just be straight up brutally honest with us and just lay the facts out than try to sugarcoat anything.
Yeah.
And that's the type of personality he has, which it just fit and worked so perfectly with what we needed.
I think he even asked, too. He said, you know, like, what do you guys want to know information?
I think you're right. Yeah.
He was so good at tailoring what we needed to know when we needed to hear it. Because some parents are not ready to have those hard conversations. Mm-hmm. But we wanted all of those hard conversations. Yeah. And he basically laid out, he said, you have three options. Option one is you can abort. A lot of families do this. Actually, there's a study that shows that over 60% of families who end up having some form of a CHD diagnosis, not just a severe, but some form, end up aborting. He said that's popular and that is an option. Number two, you can do compassionate care, which means you deliver, but you provide no intervention and you let them pass naturally. But number three, there are these surgeries that are available and you know, this is the information we have about them. Three staged surgeries. The first one happens immediately after birth. It's the most risky procedure you will have. It's the first stage. It's called a Norwood operation. It's incredibly risky, not just because the hearts are small, but because the procedure that actually has to be done in that first stage is incredibly difficult to perform. Mm-hmm. And so he said, this is the statistic that you will see different at every hospital. He said, for ours, it's somewhere near a 70% success rate. I think that number has even increased from there.
Probably.
Yeah. Just because they're improving so rapidly. And like, this is such an emerging medical field. But he said, I want to warn you about this. If you pursue the staged surgeries, no matter what route you take, option one, two, or three, we will be with you every step of the way. We will provide any information you need. We will provide all the guidance. We will provide all the care. We will support you the best that we can.
Yeah.
And what they said, for us, that means holistically. We have neurodevelopment specialists. We have, you know, nutritionists. We have, lactation specialists. We have, you know, every form of support that they have available for this particular disease group they have in their hospital.
Yeah.
And he went into detail with that. The thing that I appreciated most about him was his honesty, and it came from this form. He said, I want to warn you, Killian's defect is incredibly severe. Right now we are not seeing any left ventricle at all.
Yeah.
And what that means is that sometimes these kids have a shrunken ventricle, or it's like, you know, it's smaller, but it's still there and it could be used to kind of like brute force the circulation. But Killian, it literally from right what we can see so far, it looks like it's almost sealed shut, meaning there's absolutely no left ventricle. So he said, this is a really severe defect. I tell all of my patients with this severe of a defect that it's not a matter of if there is a complication that happens along this journey. It's a matter of when.
Yeah.
And so that was the thing that stuck out to Sam and I. So we left. We went to dinner. We began processing all of the information. It was a long 2 days.
Yeah.
It was this 2 days of back-to-back appointments with every specialist imaginable. But the one thing that I think that Sam and I left with was the like echoing question about it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So when those complications show up, where do we want to be? Mm-hmm. Do we want to be at Boston Children's, the best of the best, or do we want to be you know, somewhere that's also good but is, you know, not as advanced in this emerging medical field?
Yeah. And we also threw out the option of, you know, we had our place in Cleveland. Will we be able to facilitate a move that quickly? Well, maybe we have Killian, you know, still in Cleveland. We have the first, you know, surgery done in Cleveland, and then we move all of his care out to Boston Children's. We messed around with that idea, but it was made pretty clear to us that, you know, wherever you have that first surgery done, you want to make sure that you're there for at least a year. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember that was told to us, mm-hmm. not just by Boston Children's, but by multiple institutions that we talked to. So it was at that point we were like, okay, so wherever we have Killian, that's where we need to make sure we're at and where we're going to be for, you know, at least a year. So based off of everything that we had heard from the discussions, all the research that we did at that up to that point, we pretty much settled on Boston Children's without batting an eye, if I remember correctly. I mean, I know there was some maybe conversation, but
I remember it was on the plane ride back.
Yes.
We looked at each other and we were like, I think we both just like had that feeling of like,
we knew.
Yep. This is where we need to be for sure.
Which meant, because at this point we're, you know, late October, we had to facilitate a move with 2 months, two months and a week, something like that.
Yep.
Yeah. We had to be in Boston by 2 months because I remember Boston told us you want to be here probably 2 months before your, or what was it? Maybe it was a month. Before
Yeah,
your
a
day.
Month. Just because if you go into early labor at any point in your third trimester, you have to have a, you know, a NICU transferred to a CICU, a cardiac intensive care unit immediately.
And I remember he was due first or second week of February. So that meant.
Actually, he was due March 1st. That was his due date.
Oh, that's right. He was March. Yeah. So anyway, that gave us essentially January to make sure we were there. And you think October, well, we're almost at the end
of
October.
End of October, yeah.
Yeah. So we had November and December to facilitate. Where are we going to live? How are we going to get all of our stuff there?
How are we going to afford it?
How are we
going to
afford it? How are you going to finish school?
Oh my gosh.
You know, because you were in your last year, but
even
a move at the end of the semester, I mean, you still had another semester to go.
Yeah.
There were a lot of questions, a lot of unknowns, a lot of, how are we going to plan this?
I remember the day after we got back and we knew we had to go to Boston, we wrote a list in a notebook.
Oh my gosh.
We had to check with your job, my work, where are we going to live? How are we going to afford it? How are we going to do a budget?
How are we going to get our stuff there?
How are we going to get our stuff there?
Yeah.
Just
so many questions.
And you
remember we made that list. And we just started tasking each other out with, okay, you do this, I'll do this, you do this, I'll do this.
But we prayed before we did anything every day, we were just like, Lord, this looks impossible. Yeah. Like and we were so confused because we were like, we had this feeling that the Lord was saying, you need to go to Boston. And then now we're looking at this like impossible list. We're like, there's no way we can make this work. We're moving effectively to the most expensive city in the United States.
Yeah.
How are we going to afford? So we were looking at Airbnbs. We were looking at, you know, hotel. We were looking at hospital housing. And that was even difficult. And frankly, a little pricey too, because that's not free either. We were looking at so many things.
Yeah. So we have our lists. We have our, you know, things that need to get done. Where do we even start with talking about how that all came together? I mean, do you want to talk about how housing came together first? I mean, the jobs were pretty accommodating. Like, I remember I talked to my manager at the time. That was pretty accommodating.
So there's, and this is why I think it actually needs to be split up into two podcasts. Because I think, you know, again, I go into this detail in my book, but it's worth reading.
Yeah.
But there were every single one of these issues had God's handprint in every single one of the problems and then solutions. So I'll talk about a little bit of it, right? So like your job, it was post-COVID and everybody was going back into the office. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big lingering question of IT, of like, okay, guys, you know, we might be facing going back into the office, so just prepare. And so this was right at the news that we were going to Boston. So I was like, oh my gosh, Sam, like if they all go into the office, like that's, you know. So there were just very odd things that were happening. Like we got this diagnosis, he talked to work, and then a week later they call him in like mid-November and they said, hey, kind of like working in your favor, but like they all decided to keep only the IT department fully remote.
Yeah.
So only the IT department fully remote.
Yeah.
Everybody else had to go back to the office. So that was like, so he's like, yeah, it's not going to be a problem. Check.
Yep.
Check box. The other thing that was a big issue was our lease. We had just signed a 12-month lease. And if we broke the contract, we would have to pay all of that month in advance, but we had to go. And so I remember both of us just like praying right before we go into the leasing office and just say like, Lord, soften their hearts, like have them understand.
Yeah.
So we just tell them the story and I see the office manager just start like kind of tearing up. And so she said, you know, let me talk to my, to like the general manager. And so she said, can you come back tomorrow? And so we go back tomorrow.
She said she'll be in tomorrow. Can you come back and talk?
Yeah. So we go to the general manager and we come back tomorrow. And she was tough. Like, you know, she's a landlord of an, I get it. She was, you know, one of the tougher characters. So we talk about her story and she gets, you know, she's like, hey, listen, I'm a grandmother of, you know, three kids. I can't imagine what you're going through. And she goes, ordinarily we would have to honor the contract. However, for some odd reason, and she goes, I can't explain it. I remember this conversation. She goes, I can't explain it. But this year alone, in this particular semester, we have had a surplus of international students come to Case Western, and they all need housing in our mid-contract season. So she's like, I have five people who could take your contract right now, and I've never seen that happen in 15 years I've been a landlord here.
Yeah.
And so it was like, what? Check? I mean, guys, the list goes on. Every single thing that we wrote down, God had his fingerprint on a designed, tailored solution for every single one. And if you want more about every how all of that got laid out, check the book.
Yeah.
Because it goes into detail, and I know we want to move on to our next point.
Yeah, there's an entire chapter in the book on it. And I know you've already talked about it. I can't emphasize how amazing the book is. I mean, obviously it's a story about me, like my family and you and your perspective, but I cry every time I read through that book.
So God's providence was there.
Yes.
Before 100%. We even show up. And so the biggest one I do want to highlight though, before we move on to the next point of us traveling and getting there, was the fact of how we secured our housing and the importance of this organization that helped us.
So we
are having a really hard time every housing solution, because I have a disability, right? So we can't look at apartments that have stairs or anything requiring me to climb, because at this point I'm pregnant and I have SMA. Like, it's really hard for me to move at this point and get up and walk around, pretty like, you know, dependent on my wheelchair. And so it was really tough. So
not only that, but close enough to the hospital.
Yeah, that too. I mean, everything like was, we like, had
distance requirements for, you know, obviously beforehand it's not as big of a deal, but once Killian was born, like, we needed to be you know, within throwing distance essentially from the hospital. And with all those restrictions as it was, and then finding something that was that close to the hospital, I mean, it was darn near impossible.
Oh yeah, it was incredible. And so we, one day, we're just having a really hard time finding housing, and my whole family was on it, and they couldn't find a single housing situation that financially worked for us, but also logistically worked for us. So I remember I called a case manager who was working on Killian's case, and we were just chatting, you know, talking here and there. And she go, and I was actually in law school at an evening class, and I had to take the call early. And so we're just chit chatting towards the end. And she's like, you know, if you're driving, make sure that you're routing, even if it takes you longer to get there, make sure you're routing to, you know, NICUs that you're close by. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is stressing me out. Because she's like, if you end up going into early labor, you need to go to an ICU like as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And so she's like, just make sure, you know, doing that. She goes, have you secured housing yet? And I'm like, no, we're still trying to figure that out. And she's like, okay. You know, it's like end of November. Like, you really should.
Yeah.
We were like, and I'm like, I'm working on it. And so we get on the topic of this routing, and I was like, oh, my husband's a Marine. Like, he's, you know, he loves topography and like figuring out maps and stuff like that.
Loves topography.
Topography.
Planning, I think, is more.
Topography is study of maps.
I understand what topography is, but.
Well, I mean, like, you know, the point is he would enjoy figuring out a route to, you know,
yes,
be close, as close to the ICU as possible. So she goes, oh, your husband's a Marine? Like, you didn't tell me that. And she goes, do you know about this organization, the Fisher House of Boston? And I go, no, I've never heard of it. And she goes, well, they provide free housing for any veteran that has a child or a spouse or a loved one going through medical treatment at Boston Children's, yeah, or any other hospital in the Boston metro area. And so I go, I doubt they would have an opening. You know, but of course, God was in it this far.
Mm-hmm.
So I reach out to them and I'm like, hey, we're going to be up in Boston by January 1. Okay, y'all,
yeah,
it's like we have 1 month to go to find a house. And we're like, well, we are going to be in Boston January 1. I don't know if you have anything available. My husband's a veteran. He's a Marine. You know, just let me know.
Yeah.
And we had been looking at one option of a lease.
There was literally one Airbnb.
It was level. It had an elevator. It had parking, but it was like $3,000 a month. I said, you know what? We're going to have to go into debt, but like we got to do what we got to do.
Yeah.
And so I prayed at that moment. It was a Wednesday. And I said, okay, Lord, if this woman doesn't get back to me by Friday at 6:45, I'm going to have to secure the lease because we need to have at least something. And so, you know, I just said that prayer. Thursday, nothing happens. Thursday evening, nothing happens. Friday morning, nothing happens. At 6 o'clock on Friday, I get a call, and it's Fisher House of Boston.
Yeah.
And they said that they had.
Well, I remember specifically, you remember we were driving.
Yeah, we were driving.
We were driving. We were actually coming home to Maryland to surprise your family.
Yeah.
It was like our last, you know, hoorah meeting with everybody. You know, just hang out before we left, and we were literally in the car, and it was like you said, right before the time where, like, I remember you were specifically saying, like, all right, you know, about an hour, I'm going to book the Airbnb. Where's your card? Like, you know, let's make sure. So the timing of it,
again,
just
God's timing.
Yeah.
Everything about that. So housing is secured, and believe it or not, by mid-December, we had every detail of the plan figured out.
Yeah.
So within a month and a half, God had created paved a path out of what was completely impossible in our mind.
Yeah.
Just a month and a half prior. So we get to Boston, January 1, Christmas.
I was going to say, you're skipping over Christmas and New Year's, how we spent our first Christmas and New Year's married, sleeping on an air mattress. You're pregnant. You're third trimester pregnant, sleeping on an air mattress in an empty apartment in Cleveland, Ohio. Because at this point, everything had been packed up. You know, we had the moving all taken care of. Movers came in, took all of our stuff. That's in long-term storage. We had an air mattress that was your cousin's that we were borrowing in an empty apartment, just sitting.
We didn't buy each other any presents. We didn't have a tree.
Yeah.
The only thing we bought were matching PJs.
Oh yeah, matching PJs.
That was it.
We still have to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. So I remember being so depressed. So depressed.
Yeah, that was a time.
You know, it's like every new year you're thinking about, oh, what exciting things are going to happen this coming new year, and like all we saw was this dread. We knew that this year
darkness,
was going to be
sorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like literally the calm.
A lot of unknown.
Yeah. So January 1 comes, we board our flight, and we're off to Boston. We show up to Boston with nothing but $3,000 in our bank account total.
$3,000 in our bank account, two suitcases.
One baby outfit.
Yeah, one baby outfit, and we each had our backpack with our laptop.
Yep. So then it's kind of a waiting game. Yeah. At that point, between January 1 and, I mean, we had fetal echoes maybe every other day. And it's so funny because, like, talking to moms now, they're like, do you have your birth plan? Do you have your iPad and your books and your hair thing? And it's like, our birth plan was
your go bag. Yeah.
Our go bag. My birth plan was.
Our go bag was all of our belongings. Our belongings. That's all we had.
And my birth plan was to survive.
Yeah.
And, but the process, it's, I think it's informative to help the parents understand what to expect. Because this part was never explained to me. Of like what to expect when delivering a child with HLHS. So the point leading up to that was it's like every other appointment checking, and what they're checking for is his growth, his, you know, his weight, any additional defects that pop up, because in the third trimester things quickly escalate, and so they're just monitoring every other day. Yeah. And
all
Killian,
the extra genetic testing as he's getting bigger.
Yeah.
And
so you know, Killian was on an intrauterine growth restriction because they thought anatomically he was measuring at less than 5 pounds, and he was in my third trimester. And so that was really stressful.
Gosh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, fast forward, he was not 5 pounds. He was 6 pounds, 1 ounce. And so they were, their measurements were way off.
Yeah.
And that's, and for a CHD kid, that is really critical. Because if they are born within that poundage, like premature, they're with a compromised heart, there's just the survival rate before they get the first surgery just plummets.
Yeah.
And so that was something that they were the team was really, really worried about. Oh, and by the way, like as a mom, just don't be stressed because that's also bad for the baby, right? Yeah. So you have like all these messages of like, oh my gosh.
You know, I do want to give a special shout out though, because obviously, you know, we're going to all these appointments. They're setting us up, you know, not only cardiology, but like you mentioned, the neurodevelopment.
Yes.
Well, they specifically connected us with a doctor by the Dr. Singer. Do you remember?
Jane Singer.
Yes. And I specifically want to give her a shout out because I know we've had the conversation of how important those appointments and those conversations that we had with her beforehand. But she, in a way, kind of played like the marriage counselor slash prepping counselor for like kind of the road ahead. Like she really helped us kind of, I mean, so you think we're less than a year married, like, you know, we were still getting to know the quirks of each other in terms of how do we live together and how, well, not only that, but we have all of this other stuff we're dealing with. We just moved like several states away. All of our stuff, all of our stuff's in storage. Like we're about to have a child with a very severe cardiac defect. Like, but how do we maintain our relationship? How do we make sure we stay on the same page? Mm-hmm. Like, how do, you know, how do you deal with stressful situations? How do I deal with stressful situations? How do we come together and still work as a team through that? Mm-hmm. And she was just so, so instrumental in just us figuring that out, because I really feel like the groundwork that she helped us lay there really did help us through a lot of the extremely stressful situations and just also, you know, mildly stressful situations.
Yes.
I mean, just the day to day of, I mean, I'm still like this, but I'm an introvert. I like my quiet time, my alone time. And, you know, us having those conversations with her and you realizing that about me and, you know, me realizing different things about you just really helped us kind of make sure we were still on the same page that like, okay, Sam, you know, he's there's been a lot going on. He hasn't had the chance to just sit and just exist for like an hour in the evening. Like, okay, it's important for Sam, you know, and I'm using that as just an example. Like, obviously, you know, there were other things for your side of it, but
Like how to recognize stress in the other person. And then that's like one part of it. But then the other part of it is what do you do about it as your person's support network? Right.
Yeah.
Because Killian is important, and this is a stressful journey when your child goes through CHD. But if you don't prioritize your marriage, your family will crumble.
Yeah.
100%. It just will. And so, you know, having her help us keep that as top of mind of saying, like, you guys have each other to get. Mm-hmm. Like, Killian is fighting his own battle, and you guys are supporting him. Mm-hmm. But you guys have to be there for each other. And so what does that look like?
Yeah.
You know, when you guys are really stressed and Sam and I were also very conventional in the way, in the fact that we didn't live together prior to marriage.
Yeah.
We dated and got married in modern day eyes pretty quickly. I mean, it was like a little over a year. We met each other and then got married. It was a total of a year and a half, I would say, of meeting for the first time, dating, and then getting married.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, faster. We didn't have a long dating period. And so, you know, we didn't have as much time to kind of explore. And so that was, yeah, but she specifically, and that's what I loved about Boston's program that really stood out to me, is that it really was a holistic care of like
100%
from prenatal all the way until you leave the hospital.
Yeah.
It was holistic. And that's just one example. And so she was this wonderful, to work with. The day to the week before his delivery, it was getting a little hard for me to carry, and so there was that consideration.
Yeah.
And Killian had kind of crossed the threshold of like when they felt it was safe enough for him to be delivered, and so the MFM just said like, you know, anything later, we're running into holiday weekend, we're running into like kind of things that would prevent him from getting immediate surgery. So like, I think we need to pull the trigger. And so we scheduled the induction. Now the interesting thing about the birth plan is that you labor in a separate room, and then it's really interesting because when you're like two pushes away, they're like, okay, you need to hold it, because now we're going to have you deliver in an operating room.
Yeah.
And so it was very interesting because I was very close. And then they said, you know, like, hold your two pushes. Now, it's like any woman who has gone through labor, when you tell them when you're that close to hold, it just doesn't happen. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was really, really difficult. So they're wheeling me over into this operating room. And then there's like 30 people there.
They open the store. Now, you know, we're in the room that Bryn's laboring in. I mean, how many doctors, nurses, staff? Like, there was maybe like 5, 6 in the room with us at the time.
Yeah.
We listened to this room, and like Brent said, bright lights. There's like 30, 35, 40 people, like a team from Boston Children's, a team from, you know, this specialty, that specialty. And they're all just in different areas of the room, and they're just waiting.
Yeah. They have their hands like folded together. Yes. And they're just like staring, and I'm just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Of course, like at that point I don't care about who sees what or whatever, but you know, it was just incredible. It's like, I have an audience now.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah. Killian's here.
And so Killian's, you know, delivered, and then the really cool part is that they kind of mentally prepped me to not have any skin to skin before they took him away.
Yeah.
And so the best part of that.
Well, they didn't know how bad things were going to be. I mean, obviously you kind of have an idea, but exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
but he immediately cried, and they were like, okay, he's looking really good. Like, we're going to give you 20 seconds to kind of hold him. And so that was a really cool moment, because that was truly, I look back on that and I felt like time froze. Like, you have very few of those moments where you feel like the significance of the event before it even happens. Like, I didn't know where this was going to go. I didn't know if where any of this was going to lead.
Yeah.
And it was just like, that was the moment I had with him before any of it happened. And it was like in the moment, and then preserved in my mind, felt like that was just a freezing of time. And it was so cool. So they took him away. And then, I mean, you were with them, so you have a better, and I think this is helpful for parents who have a baby who's, you know, mm-hmm. going to have a heart defect. So,
yeah. So,
I mean, you were with him.
Yeah. Obviously, Bryn gave birth in the, you know, adult women's hospital, and Boston Children's Hospital was connected. So immediately, you know, he's born skin to skin. They do a couple things.
They take him away from me.
Essentially.
Right?
Yeah. So they do a couple things to kind of preserve the current state of his heart, so that way he's prepped for the first surgery in a couple days. There was a medication specifically that they give him. So I think it was one valve or something doesn't close, because that was very integral to the surgery. So they do this. They make sure he's stable. And then they say, okay, we're wheeling him over. And they give the dads an option. Now, this was at least at Boston Children's. They give the dads an option. You can either stay with your wife or you can follow us over to the room where your child's going to be before the surgery, where they're going to be in the cardiac ICU. And I remember at first I was like, well, I'm not going to leave my wife's side. Like, I'm not going to leave. And then I remember you looked at me and you're like, no, you're going with our child.
Yeah, I was like, get out of here.
And I'm like, okay.
Kicked you out.
Yeah. So, and we decide this beforehand. But mm-hmm. So anyway, they say, okay, it's time. We're taking him over. And I'm just walking with a cloud of like 20 doctors through the halls. Mm-hmm. You know, Killian's essentially in this like,
it's like an bubble incubator,
crib, bassinet. It was wild.
Yeah.
We have a video social media of it, but
it's like it's kind of cool. I mean, not cool, but it's like, it's very interesting how they move through the hospital with this. It's like they have, we actually saw it the day we actually got our first fetal echo at Boston, which was kind of weird. It was like a foreshadowing.
Yeah.
We saw this team walk past us and we were like, we turned to each other and we were like, I think that's what is going to happen to Killian.
Yeah.
Fast forward. It's like a team of like 8-9 doctors that are like walking this tiny, tiny infant in a box through the hall with IVs and monitors and like,
it's crazy.
It's quite a sight. Yeah.
So we get over there, get him into the room. And so obviously at this point, Bryn is, you know, taken back to the labor room. She's, mm-hmm. you know, I'm there with Killian and, I essentially checked in with the nurse where Killian was going to be, established relationship with her. I'm pretty sure. What was her name?
Michelle.
It was Michelle. That's right. Yes. I couldn't remember if it was Michelle or
the best first nurse we've ever had.
Betsy was right after the first surgery.
She was. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So we had Michelle first.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, check in with Michelle. I'm like, you know, here's my phone number. She's like, I already have all that information in my chart. Don't mm-hmm. even worry about it. Go find your wife.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially it was me establishing, okay, cool. I know where he's at. This is the room number. That's what my baby looks like. Let me put a mark on his forehead. Just kidding. So anyway.
So I think that's where we, you know, I think that's where we kinda, can leave off.
Yeah, because I mean, there was like a little bit of a lull from that point until the first surgery. You know, obviously we're meeting some of the surgeons.
I do want to talk about the postpartum experience.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if we do that now or maybe we did. I'll talk about the postpartum experience now. You know, I was not mentally prepared for the postpartum experience. You know, postpartum is hard enough when you are discharged and at home and, you know, doing, you know, you have your baby blues and stuff like that, but no one really prepares you. And I think this is really an area that is lacking for support, like substantial support for these mothers who are facing incredibly traumatic experiences, is the postpartum support. So I, you know, having SMA, I had, you know, this is, might be TMI, but I had a grade 3 injury. And so I was pretty messed up from, you know, from the delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also had SMA, and postpartum with SMA, your core is wiped. I mean, I couldn't even stand. It was really scary to be that weak after I delivered.
Yeah.
Again, there's just not a lot of people who have had SMA and a baby, and so I just wasn't prepared for that level of weakness. And so I really needed help. I really needed help from a lot of people in my postpartum journey. But then I didn't have like a comfortable chair. I didn't have a bed to lay down in for 8 hours. For the 3 days that were, was my postpartum experience, I was in a wheelchair, or I was in a hard hospital chair. I didn't have a bed. I didn't have anything to lay on. It was kind of rough. It was kind of rough because the option was I leave the hospital and I go lay down in a bed without my baby in a completely separate room. And there's something, you know, I was with my baby for 9 months. And so to go home and have nothing to cradle, have nothing, was terrible.
Yeah.
There's just something psychological about like, I am to nurture. I am to help my baby. And where is my baby?
Yeah.
I
can't remember. Did we stay the night in the hospital? Well, obviously you were still still admitted in the Brigham Women's. Oh, that's right. We stayed over there.
Yeah. The first night We stayed in the postpartum ward.
Yeah.
The morning after we got released, or no, I was there for another day.
Yeah, then, I think it was two nights.
So I was there for two nights. And then I think I was actually discharged on day two because we spent the night before his surgery, which was the third day after he was born.
That's right. Yeah.
So we did spend the night, but I held him the entire night before his surgery. So I was sitting in a chair and I didn't want to move. It was just kind of this moment where I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. I read all the statistics. We prepared for 4 months for this moment. And I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. I don't know if he's going to make it. I don't know if he's going to have a cardiac arrest. I don't know what side of the statistic that we fought so hard to be here for. Of 70% of kids end up surviving the first major operation. Is he going to be the 30% or is he going to be the 70%? And so I held him the entire night, and that was the hardest night I've ever had in my life, because he couldn't eat. I, was trying to get breastfeeding down through a pump. He couldn't eat. He was hungry. And so all I could do was soothe him. And every time I would soothe him to go back to sleep, I would just crumble in a pile of tears because that's when baby blues hits.
Yeah.
It was your third day out. You have your hormone crash. And here you have to hand your baby over to a heart surgeon, not sure if he is going to make it.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I talk about with the postpartum support that is really lacking for moms. And that's not a dig on anyone. I think it's just this experience hasn't risen to the level of concern for need and support that is really needed for these moms. And so that was my postpartum, was like, and we have a picture of this when Killian went into surgery the next morning, which, we'll talk about that with our next podcast. Part of my postpartum recovery was shoving, couches together to make a bed for me to lay down while I recovered. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting too, because they were going to wait until the following week for his procedure. You remember, for the Norwood.
Yeah.
They were going to wait until it was Tuesday, because that Monday was President's Day.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the surgeon came and talked to us. I think it was day one. And they said, hey, I think we're going to need to kind of expedite this. We're going to do it on a Saturday.
But this is the level of care that was like, this is why we went to Boston, because I remember our heart surgeon came in and he said, I don't trust his heart. I've seen, he was doing something called over circulating, which meant that there were parts of his heart that were too wide and he was getting too much, like his lungs were essentially being flooded with blood. And so it was becoming really, really hard for him to breathe. And so he's like, we could try to wait over the weekend, but I have seen if we've waited too long and these kids don't do well. So he's like, I'm going to pull a team together and we're going to do this thing on tomorrow. We're going to do it on Saturday.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They give us like 24 hours.
Yeah. It was not a big notice, but this is why, like, we went to Boston because
exact of moments like that.
Exact moments like that. And Killian's journey was not easy, as many of you know, but we'll go into how Boston Children's handled every single one of our issues exactly how it needed to be handled.
Yep.
So, guys, that's where we're going to leave it. Part two, we're going to get into the, I know it's such a cliffhanger.
Put a pin in it. Yeah. We'll get to the rest of the nitty gritty stuff. The story is just as amazing as that first half. So, definitely, if you enjoyed this first half, make sure to subscribe, make sure that you keep this on the top of your feed, you get alerted. So that way the next time the next episode drops, you know.
Thank you for joining, and stay tuned for part two of Killian's story, where we will go through all of the surgeries, all of the drama of an extended year-long ICU stay. We will see you then.